dinosaurs for Big Ten Talk. It's Off Tackle Empire.
Welcome back to Off Tackle Empire. We're going to preview week two in the Big Ten, week one of everybody else, because, you know, the Big Ten just grinds harder. But once again, this is the only Big Ten podcast that, that I contribute to. So once again, I'm Steve Braun. I'm with Jeff Chesky, and we are here to talk about Ohio State at Minnesota and other more compelling matchups like Fordham at Nebraska.
Yeah, well, you know, the interesting speculation, again, since there was nothing else to talk about this first weekend, really, as far as outcomes goes, unless you want to talk about UCLA dunking on Hawaii and looking just a teeny little bit like vintage Chip Kelly, Oregon.
Yeah, let's talk about Zach Charbonnet having more success than any Michigan running back has had in the Rose Bowl since 1988. Ah, I stole your joke.
Yeah, right. So six carries for 100 plus yards, three touchdowns. No, Michigan couldn't use him last season at all. Not at all.
That was literally was his whole season. He had one touchdown and a little over 100 yards in five games last year. He had six attempts over 100 yards and three touchdowns. Granted, yeah, it was against Hawaii, but...
But we digress. So yeah, as you mentioned, Ohio State, Minnesota is a good place to start because it's one of our two Thursday night games here in week one. I kind of hate it. Minnesota's come to be associated with this, so whatever. You know, if it's just
the one Louisville of the Big Ten.
Yeah, that's what I think. I mean, look, there's a Patino who used to coach there and got fired because, well, for reasons. Never mind, different reasons than the other Patino, but you can see the parallels there. So,
yikes, I mean,
Ohio State of Minnesota.
Patino was so bad, he got fired for losing games.
Yeah, that takes some doing to be a Patino to get fired for your coaching record as opposed to, you know, all the heinous shit you do off the field. Yeah, that's quite something. But he landed on his feet. And in any case, we've got Ohio State and Minnesota. There were a couple of lingering major storylines for each of these teams that are still kind of unresolved. We're here Sunday night, so there may be a firmer announcement, but I really wouldn't expect it. So on the one hand, with Minnesota, the question is, what is Chris Ottman-Bell's status? He sustained an injury a couple of weeks ago or so in practice that looked very serious at the time. It has since kind of sounded as though actually maybe not so bad as it seemed initially. He was declared basically week to week by PJ Fleck. And then most recently, the news was he may actually be able to go against Ohio State in week one, which would be huge and might even let Minnesota keep this within two scores at the end of the first quarter, in my opinion.
You know what it feels like for any team that's not as talented as Penn State to play Ohio State? You know, and of course, Indiana felt differently than this last year. But in general, it feels a lot like if you're playing a one-on-one, you know, one life in Super Smash Brothers, but you're starting at 100% damage. You can hang in there. You can deal damage. You can hang in there punch for punch. But they hit you with one big one, and you're flying off the screen, and it's game. Boom. That's it. You're never catching back up.
It's sudden death, but the other guy doesn't start at 300%. Yeah, I can kind of see that vibe. Ohio State's major unresolved story, of course, is that they still have not announced a starter. Not really clear from what I could tell if they're going to do that.
Dude, all who signs, cares, man? Adrian Martinez could win the Heisman there.
Ooh, okay, hold on. Let me run through this thought. Let me run through a couple simulations in my brain here. How many turnovers could an Ohio State quarterback get away with before he'd be replaced by the blue chip behind him and lose his opportunity to rack up stats for the Heisman? I'm doing like, again, you can't see me doing this because it's a podcast, but you can picture like the Doctor Strange thing.
No. Here's what I'm doing.
Reading all these potential realities, like in what circumstance would that happen?
That's not what I'm picturing. What I'm picturing is the GIF from that Big Ten commercial where it's Tim Beckman like staring at things on a clear chalkboard.
Yeah, with a look of wonderment, like who wrote
on
the window?
These things?
Who wrote on the window? Oh, brother. So that's an interesting exercise. We might have to revisit that at some point. But anyway, the thought is that CJ Stroud is probably the leader there. He's the only one with any real game experience. One of the candidates is supposed to be a high school senior right now. Presumably Stroud is going to be the starter week one, and all expectations are that he'll be very good off the bat because he's got an elite offensive line and an incredible wide receiver group in front of him. A little bit of a different look in the running back room, to be sure, but I still think Travion Henderson and Master T are going to be enough of a 1-2 punch that all Stroud has to do is not be freshman Art Sitkowski, which seems impossible at Ohio State, and they should be just fine. But we'll see. Maybe there's a surprise and somebody else has secretly taken hold of that. In either case, for Minnesota to keep up here, boy, think back to Minnesota's defensive performances from last year. They got a little bit better down the stretch, that's true, and they do have a good amount of experience because of how bad they were last year. But in what circumstances are they – like, picture Minnesota's linebackers in coverage on Ohio State's guys in the slot. Like you know, Smith and Jigba, who hasn't really done much for Ohio State yet, but by all accounts is going to be their next superstar receiver. And then he lines up against Mariano Storie-Marin because of a mismatch or a quick tempo thing or something. Like, how does this game work out in Minnesota's favor? I just don't see it.
Ohio State, when Ohio State – marches all the way through the Big Ten championship game with all 10 wins, they will have won more consecutive conference games than early aughts Miami.
Consider that, and consider the conference that Miami was playing in at the time. They were not in a conference.
They were in the Big East.
Yeah, they were not in a conference of Florida State or with modern Clemson. They were in the early 2000s Big East. I think the Big East was a little better back then. Than the version we remember before it collapsed. But
that's what we're talking about here. I really don't even think of them as being in the same league because it's like when you talk about teams in the same league, usually you expect results against them to mean something. I mean, do you think that results from your games against Ohio State mean anything?
No. And that's, if you think big picture, I think this is probably true for each of us. Like, given where our teams are, the goal within like the next 2 to 3 seasons is, can we be the one that has the number one contender belt to have the best shot to take Ohio State down? That's where the rest of us are. And we could, there's all kinds of conversations you could have about where that's a healthy place for a conference to be, but what exactly is there to be done about it from the top? I mean, the other schools just have to do better. And so
by the time we can take that belt there, Ohio State's going to be gone. But you know, that gives you an idea of how I feel about this game because of what we're talking about. I don't want to disrespect Minnesota, but like, you have to understand what we're talking about here. Like, I don't think I have Minnesota as 8-4, right? I have them as a solid team. I just Ohio State has played solid teams, solid Big Ten teams, and sent them home like 56-3.
That's true. If you're looking for ways in which this realistically will be kept close, though, I think Minnesota might have an angle that most other teams don't, and that is, I do think their run game should be able to get some traction against Ohio State. Ohio State's obviously hugely talented defensively, but they've got a lot of new guys. And yeah, I know Haskell Garrett's back and he's really good. They've got these killer defensive ends, but their linebacking group is very new, talented, but new, or upperclassmen who haven't played much. Their defense is going to be substantially more vulnerable than their offense early on. Minnesota wants to run the ball a lot anyway.
And Minnesota does have enough of a passing game that they can keep Ohio State honest for at least the first half. So that is going to be interesting, but they can't really afford to not score touchdowns.
Right. So here's the thinking to me, which is that especially if Ottman Bell is able to play and be most of his normal self to give them a deep ball threat, if they get any traction with Ibrahim early on and they can, you know, he's a guy that you can easily give the ball to 30 times and be confident he's going to get better as he goes on. If they get into a lather with this good offensive line, this excellent run blocking offensive line, such that they're able to hold the ball and keep Ohio State's offense off the field, well, then all it takes is, again, keep in mind, Ohio State's got a new quarterback, whoever it is. If, you know, say the guy misses a couple throws on the first series or two, such that they have to punt, and then Minnesota gets the ball back, either up a field goal or a touchdown, and they go on another long drive. And now the quarterback who made a couple mistakes, even if they're little ones, has to sit there and think about it for a long time. And by the time he gets back on the field, maybe he feels a little bit of pressure start to ratchet up, because not only is he playing for Ohio State on the road, you know, expecting to go to the playoff at the end of the season, but he's looking at three blue chips on the sideline next to him. And who knows how close the competition ends up being. Maybe it's a thing that's decided on the last day of camp, such that he knows, look, it was really close. The coach thinks that at least one of these other guys is almost as good as me. I need to be good right now. And maybe he forces something, or there's a mix up in the communication or a play call or something that he doesn't get. I'm just saying there are stranger things have happened. I'm not predicting a win by any means, but Death Stars do blow up occasionally, right?
So I have a question. Let's say that Mohammed Ibrahim manages to keep the clock rolling such that it is the first play of the fourth quarter when Homie enters the game, player to be named later, the Ohio State starting quarterback, enters the game again, down seven, and throws a pick six. Is his name in the transfer portal by the end of the game?
Interesting question, right? Because in that situation, even knowing that the three backup options you have are very talented, there's a good chance that whoever it is has very little game experience. Are you really going to turn to somebody in that situation and be like, all right, you go fix it? What if he sucks too?
Why not? You're a pro football team. You're every bit a professional football team.
Well, that's okay, what you do. No, hold on. No. Hold on. Let's carry that analogy out then. If Drew Brees fucks up early in the fourth quarter at any point in his career in New Orleans, they don't pull him and put in Jameis Winston or Sean Mannion or whoever was backup.
Counterpoint, they'd have won the game last year in the playoffs. But I digress.
Last year was a totally different situation from what I'm talking about.
That's too is an experienced Drew Brees, because we're not talking about guys with game experience, are we?
Right, but you tried to compare it to an NFL situation. That's not what it is with a new quarterback in college. As talented as they are, it's not reasonable to assume that they're automatically going to be good. And this is the same point that I tried to make when we had our preseason rankings. Everybody else on this site linked the unnamed Ohio State quarterback as the best of the conference. That's preposterous. You don't even know who it is. How could you possibly know he's going to be the best quarterback?
That's funny, because when we did that, Quinn Ewers wasn't even an option. So wait a second. If Quinn Ewers starts, then that means that the guy that was there was technically not even on the guy that
yeah guy that would that mean
starts that, them was not even on our list.
Right. Yeah. And he was still named the preseason quarterback or player, the whatever quarterback of the year by Off Tackle Empire. Quinn Ewers, Texas quarterback. Class of 2022 quarterback of it. Yeah. All right. Anyway, we spent enough time on that. Look,
I put down a fairly large sum of money on Ohio State -225 to win the Big Ten, because I can't believe they would pay me back nearly 40% for Ohio State to win the Big Ten. There's no chance they don't. Even if Indiana beats them, I don't trust Indiana to not lose two games.
Probably so. I think you have a tendency to do a little bit of a Chicken Little thing with Ohio State, and you're doing it here again. Cause we're trying to talk about, look, is there any way this game is interesting? What angles is Minnesota tagging for? And here you are once again, running around in a circle, shouting about how much better than they are than the rest of us. I'm not saying that you're necessarily wrong. I'm saying
want to talk about him anymore. Let's talk about Temple Rutgers.
I tried to, and then you said, hey, I put a lot of money on them to win the conference. So anyway.
It's an investment, man. If I had a guaranteed 40% return in 3 months, I'd do it.
So
Rempel is the game.
You know, considering that Temple was a one-win team last season, this game may actually be a little more interesting than it looks on paper. And obviously, we're all quite confident about Rutgers, given the steps they made in the first year under Greg Schiano's return tour. Interesting thing about Temple, though, they had a whole bunch of new players last year. They also bring in an important – do you remember the name Dwan Mathis?
I do, but I don't know why.
He, at one point, was a Michigan State prospect, a guy that they were – aggressively recruiting. He ended up committing to Ohio State, did not stay there long, went to Georgia. He was actually Georgia's opening day starter last year. Do you remember that? But he was either injured or benched almost immediately. JT Daniels was hurt. Jamie Newman sat out. And so he was kind of the last man standing at the beginning of the year. but he didn't last long. I think he ended up getting hurt himself. And then what the hell was the guy's name? The tiny little walk-on who ended up starting for Georgia most of the season. But anyway, Mathis didn't stick around. He transferred again. So he's now at Temple. Still, again, still a former well-regarded dual threat prospect.
Stetson Bennett is the guy.
Yes, that's the guy who ended up being the starter. Not that that mattered, but anyway, he's got a threat in Jaden Blue, who was over 1,000 yards in 2019. Again, it's a 7-game sample last year, and they had a lot of guys opt out. They had a lot of guys get hurt, so they're playing a lot of new guys. They don't have a huge talent base to begin with. They did lose Arnold Adekiti to Penn State via transfer, but still, I wouldn't necessarily look past this game if you're Rutgers. I don't think Rutgers is at a point where they can afford to look past anybody, especially, you know, a team in the American Conference like Temple is not an automatic win for anybody in the bottom half of the Big Ten. So I think Rutgers has to be careful this game. They should still be the better team. If they continue their development curve, they should win pretty handily. But Temple is a little bit of a live wire, and there's also kind of a regional thing. Temple being in Philadelphia, Rutgers in New Jersey, this, you know, agreeing to play a team like that always has some risks, because presumably many Temple guys would have liked to play in the Big Ten, for even if it's for Rutgers. And so maybe a little more interesting than that game would appear on paper. I'd still feel pretty good if I'm the Fighting Shianos, but not a foregone conclusion by any means.
Yeah, I just don't know that much about Temple.
They have fallen off the radar in a big way the last couple
years. You want to consider that, like, my first impression of them is still the Matt Rhule Temple, which,
yeah, you still think defense. You probably still think they're crazy good defensively, that, but they're still, like, capable. Yeah,
but that's crazy because, like, I also don't understand quite what Rod Carey's deal is, because he kind of just was like meh. He took over for Dave Doran at Northern Illinois, who had taken over from Jerry Kill, and proceeded to kind of, they weren't as good, but they still occasionally, like, they got to the title game the one time, and then they actually won that one.
Yeah, that was the one we were at, wasn't it, where they came back?
Yeah, and because I'm from Illinois and my mom went there for a master's, I was kind of pumped, and y'all were very sad. You cried some serious Spencer what was the guy's name? Spencer tears?
I don't remember. I certainly don't remember.
Yeah, it was. You cried some serious Spencer tears. That's the guy.
Was he the very short receiver who had who jumped out of the building?
I believe so. Yes.
Yeah.
So we're talking about a coach whose legacy at Northern Illinois is, like, mixed, given, you know, what he did versus his predecessors, going to now in his third year as the Temple head coach. After, of course, they had that false start hiring Manny Diaz, I just don't know what to make of it.
No, well, you know, in 2009, they did make it to 8-5, and then it was real. Like, last year went about as badly for them as it could have. I think they're going to be better this year. I think this is a win that would age well if Rutgers can get it. And like I said, this is a team that can beat Rutgers pretty easily if they don't continue to show marked improvement.
Well, here's the thing, though. They got Thad Ward, the guy who came up with the phrase Liddyville at Illinois. Notably, Liddyville went 4-1, or no, 3-1, because he was gone by 2020 against Rutger.
Okay.
Well, maybe he left after 2018. I don't know. Okay.
I guess they've got a little bit of an inside angle, but to keep this moving, the one Friday night game, Michigan State at Northwestern.
We're going to have some live on-site reporting there. Both of our correspondents, both of us, are going to be there.
Yeah, I'm going to be pretty drunk by then if all goes according to plan. So we'll see how I go about convincing security at Ryan Field that I'm a licensed, a credentialed member of the press. But we'll see what we can do to get, you know, field level, maybe get into one of the locker rooms, introducing guys. But as I've said repeatedly,
I don't know, man. It's at Northwestern. Maybe we just, like, go down to where nobody's sitting.
Yeah, you just go down, like, the 6-foot berm that separates the field from the first row of seats, like you're at a high school game, and it's fine.
And then the event staff tries to stop you, and you're like, bro, you're at a Northwestern game. Chill.
Yeah, relax. Nobody's doing anything energetic here. It's fine. as I've said repeatedly
would
over
you like the entire, to see my Tolstoy?
Okay, so I'm just going to complete this thought this time. I don't know what to make of Northwestern or of Michigan State in this game because, and I don't know how anyone could. They've got 40 new players since last season. They're installing a system with their first real complete offseason since the coaching staff was hired. I feel like they're going to be better. I don't know how much better. And I don't think I'm going to know after this game either, because Northwestern is this weird null zone of quality regarding their opponents where, yeah, they could beat almost anybody and lose to almost anybody. So I wonder if that's going to continue to be true. I wonder what we'll see out of starting quarterback Hunter Johnson, who looked terrible in the past, but there again, for reasons we've discussed, it turned out to be pretty good reasons for that. So he still obviously has the talent in him in some capacity. I don't think he's got the weapons, but we'll see. You know, you assume the defense is going to be good. This game probably doesn't get out of the 20s, regardless of how it goes. Or maybe it turns into one of the random absolute barn burners between these two teams, and it's 58-56 at the end of regulation. So all which is to say, again, I have no earthly idea what to expect here. I, by all rights, Northwestern is the better team, but that was the case last year too, and we saw how that went.
Yeah, when does that ever matter? So I'm going to go back to our discussion in our Slack channel on the Sunday morning coming down thing, where in some thread that we had, I simply said, look, not that you don't know this, but man, this was absolutely a game they couldn't afford to lose. And they were talking about how could they get to a bowl? And then somebody was saying, you know, Northwestern, like, I don't think they could win at Northwestern. To which MN Wildcat said, what I think is an evergreen thought. Anyone who knows how a Northwestern game will finish is lying.
Yeah, so we could easily see a Michigan State win here. And in my presumed enthusiastic state, maybe I'll drop some hot takes worth remembering. I kind of doubt it, though. Even drunk, I don't think I'm necessarily going to predict a 9-win season on Michigan State, even if they win this game.
I think that Northwestern will lose this game only because it's their first game of the season. It's early September.
It would
this
also
the
be
the Northwestern you want.
It would also be terribly funny if they lose this game and then run the table and get left out of the playoff because their one loss is to like a 4-win Michigan State team or something.
I have them losing to Duke and Nebraska and then running that, like winning their last five or something.
Probably not the most ridiculous prediction you could make, again, based on our past data. Okay, so we'll move now to the full slate of games on Saturday, a mixture of non-con and conference games. We'll start with the out-of-conference, Western Michigan at Michigan. Certain Michigan fans that I have encountered, I don't know about you, are being fake anxious about this game, saying, oh, Harbaugh's done such a disastrous job, we might lose to Western. I haven't dropped this stat on them yet, but I know you've seen it out there, such that Scott Frost would have to go, what is it, 37-1 or something like that to match Jim Harbaugh's current Michigan record, if you want a comparison of how the tenures are going. So Michigan fans who want to be all woe is me about this, get over yourselves. All that being said, Western does not have the talent to stand up to Michigan, especially in the Big House. They're starting a former Michigan State skill player at running back. So that's all there is to say, in my opinion.
They're a passing team that should be pretty decent against teams that don't have five stars in their defensive backfield. If Michigan loses this game, they need to immediately fire everybody.
Yeah, sure. So the only proviso there is this is Michigan's first game implementing a completely new defensive scheme where they're doing all this pattern matching and more NFL concepts imported from the Ravens versus Don Brown's straight man across the board all the time. I mean, honestly, this is the type of game where if they were still running Don Brown's system, you'd expect them to put up a goose egg on Western and get 7 or 8 sacks or whatever. So
this Western Michigan is not PJ Fleck Western, but no. It is a lot like Bill Cubitt Western Michigan, which is to say they've got a passing attack that could keep them in games against much better teams and really, really annoy them. But if you lose this game, then you're Ron Zook.
Yeah, more or less. So probably not much to see here. Spread's probably going to settle, somewhere in the mid-20s, I would guess. It wouldn't be the dumbest idea because, again, Western's defense is not going to be able to stand up to what should be a very good Michigan run game. And this is probably an instance where with a new group of offensive linemen, they're going to look to establish the run early, often, repeatedly, as Jim Harbaugh's want to do anyway. Moving on to, we mentioned this game earlier and also just a minute ago, Fordham at Nebraska. Fordham, an FCS team out of, I believe, New York City, or is it just New York State? But either way, not exactly a North Dakota State. Not a terrible FCS team, I don't think, although it's been a couple years since I looked at them in any detail. But really, the only drama here is, does the sellout streak continue for Nebraska? They'll probably say that it does, even if it's a lie. So why is that a story? I don't know.
I think we may have seen the most Nebraska fans in a Memorial Stadium that we're going to see this year.
Right. But in terms of whether the sellout streak continues, the only way that we know that is based on what the school says. And what
you tell Nebraska that there's going to be ham, and you tell Nebraska that there's going to be Fords.
Oh, shit.
They like both of them things. So you were talking about this whole Scott Frost would have to go this record and this. He would have to win his next 9 games to match the record of Mike Riley at Nebraska, to match his win percentage.
I'm just going to let that one sit there for a second. That's quite a fact.
A little bit of sizzle right there. You're gonna let that sink in and let it use your bathroom?
Jeez. We're keeping it runs of themed, aren't we? I was going to say, I'm just going to put that one on the grill and let it go for a little bit. So we've discussed this next matchup really only in the context of one player, Texas San Antonio featuring Sincere McCormick at Illinois.
This is a much more dangerous running game than Nebraska.
As it turns out, probably going to be the case.
Not even joking. I am a bit concerned about this game because, really what's going to happen here is we're going to need our secondary to be able to take down their passing attack, because I trust that we will adjust to stuff the box against Sincere McCormick. And if we stuff the box against even the best, even against the best CUSA running attack, we should have the advantage athletically to be able to shut it down. But that's only if, you know, then the three guys that you have defending in the backfield can shut down what's been a bit of a, you know, an uneven passing attack for UTSA.
Sure.
They had a winning record. They were a competitive team. I am really concerned about Sincere McCormick. I'm not going to lie. I've been on the record saying this. I could absolutely see. I mean, we went down 21-6 to a much worse UTSA team, although our coach was Tim Beckman then.
And so your concern about McCormick is earnest, you would say. That's a good adjective for it.
I would say that my concern is really genuinely heartfelt about Mr. McCormick here.
I can't think of a better word for it. So I'm glad that we're more or less on the same page on that. Although I will say that you trying to convince me that UTSA is and should be a legit threat to Illinois after, again, seeing an offseason and now one game of confidence from Brett Bielema. This is what you're doing right now is how I feel trying to talk you back from doom spiraling about Ohio State every time.
Well, I have a question. Do you think Nebraska would beat UTSA? Probably, I'm not sure.
Yeah, probably. Can you hold on. We're not in the same place, so I can't check your tabs, but I'm going to ask your scout's honor on this. Can you name another player on UTSA's roster right now?
I don't need to. He's our best fantasy player.
Okay. There you go. So against the Big Ten,
I can name all kinds of players on Nebraska. I know them for doing terrible things.
Sure. Here's what I'll warrant you. If UTSA's coach, who I couldn't name, had access to Nebraska's talent, you might be in a lot more trouble. But by the same token,
I think we're going to win this game. Yeah. I do. I just think that it might not be quite as smooth sailing as was, say, the middle 8 minutes of the Nebraska-Illinois game.
Okay, but think about the selective is like, you're saying that you don't think this entire game is going to go as well as the one fantastic stretch of football you played? What are you talking about? Of course it won't. Oh, God. All right. Okay, so we'll move now to what I'll call the interesting non-conference games of the week. Not that Temple Rutgers isn't interesting, but find something else to do with your Thursday night. Oregon State at Purdue. Question for you, Steve Thumposaurus Braun. Can you name Oregon State's head coach without looking?
Oh my God. I feel like either his first name is John or his last name is Smith.
It is John Smith. Yes.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Now, okay, so hang on. Before you give yourself too much credit, statistically speaking, in terms of the demographics of college football coaches, you had a decent chance there, right? And second,
I actually did know specifically that thing. It's just that I was thinking John Smith, but then I was thinking, wait, am I thinking John L. Smith? Wait, it's either a John or a Smith.
You might as well be thinking John L. Smith as far as
he's Dan Smith, BYU.
So how long would you say John Smith has been the coach at Oregon State?
I think this is his third year.
It's his fourth. Okay, fourth, so you got closer. I was assuming you'd do what I did, which was, man, that Gary Anderson thing where he just walked away from the team in the middle of the year, that was crazy. That was like 4 whole months ago. But no, it turns out it was 4 years ago, and you wouldn't know because you haven't heard anything from Oregon State since then.
No, I do know two things about them. I know Jake Luton, and I know Jamar Jefferson, neither of whom are with the team anymore.
Yeah.
Anybody that shows up in this college football fantasy thing remotely just shows up, has a good week, is going to catch my radar at some point. And so I all I know to expect from them is, and I know Zariah Beeson, who was a one-time Illinois recruit. So
yeah. Well, their most likely starter at quarterback, although I don't think this has been decided for sure yet, is Tristan Gebbia, a former Nebraskan. And boy, wouldn't it be nice if Nebraska had a little bit of depth in their quarterback room such that they didn't have to stick with Adrian Martinez. Now, it always comes back to the Huskers, man, I'll tell you. But anyway, he's most likely going to be their starter at quarterback. As you mentioned, Jamar Jefferson's gone. They don't really have a clear backup of that level. They've brought in a few transfers from other places that could be interesting. There's Treshawn Harrison at wide receiver who could be useful. A Georgia transfer, Makia Tung, which is a pretty solid name. Give that name a slurp, but you don't expect Oregon State to be, I'll put it, if Oregon State is a serious threat to Purdue, let alone if they beat them, Jeff Brohm's in quietly a lot of trouble. He's never going to get the press or the coverage that Scott Frost did. And he had a little bit more goodwill from, you know, whomping on Ohio State early on that has, I think, buoyed him higher despite really having a comparably disappointing results the last couple of years. And when we were talking about Purdue in the offseason, we mentioned that the excuses probably kind of have to stop this year. I'm not saying Brohm has spilled many of them out there, but if nobody else then from guys like me who are fans of him and his style of play, they've got to put up in the win-loss column this year. And losing to a team like Oregon State in your debut week of the season, that's not going to be a good sign. So
important for Purdue to win this game. Actually,
yeah.
We talked about this. Well, what we didn't talk about is that Makia Tung is apparently the son of, I looked this up, Reggie Tung, former Chiefs and Seahawks defensive back. That's what I thought about. But anyway, to get back to what we're talking about,
yeah,
we texted about, well, what happened to Scott Frost? Was he always just kind of a shitty football coach? And we said that he didn't actually take over nothing at UCF. That 0-12 season was just 2 years after they won the Fiesta Bowl with Blake Bortles. It wasn't totally bare, but he was a guy who was a brilliant play caller, a football genius at, you know, the top end G5 conference, really the American and the Mountain West are the two big dogs. Right.
Before that, when he was a coordinator at Oregon, because there was a coordinator experience in there too.
A play calling, a football genius, a wunderkind. And he continued to do that, stepping into his own as a head coach in a group of five team there. And it has not translated at all. He's proven to be just done unbelievably stupid things. That's the question. Was he always a dumb football coach? No, I just don't think that he ever had quite what it took to manage a Power Five football program on this level. When you talk about, you know, it's just when you're playing with this caliber of players, it is different, and you take on more of a managerial position. And what better example of that than Jeff Brohm?
Yeah. Well, and you know, the other thing to remember about Oregon State, which I should have meant Bob a second ago, is they did beat Oregon last year. So it's not like this is a coaching staff with no chops whatsoever. It's just they've kind of flown under the radar, being Oregon State they're in a position not unlike Michigan State. Unless they're extremely good, it's pretty easy to ignore them from a national perspective.
Well, you talking about this being a prove it year for Jeff Brohm?
I don't
Jeff
think that's
Brom has won the same number of games over the last 3 years as Lovie Smith.
That's tough. And it's also a stat that loses a little bit of meaning in the context of a shorter schedule last year. But again, they won their first two games and then went 0 for the rest of the season. It's not like playing a couple more would have made you hugely confident that they're going to get to six wins or something. So
would you rather go 4-6-2 or 6-4-2? I mean, you'd rather do neither, but still, Brom did the latter.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I don't think I have a good answer for that. So,
I mean, really the big difference between him and Scott Frost is he's not recruiting as well. He has actually won things at Purdue, although not that many. He won one game that was enormous. He went to a bowl in his first season. I mean, he's been to two bowl games. He's won more. And he hasn't embarrassed himself at the press conferences, but
it's still a fair question of whether that's enough.
Yeah, it is. Their trajectories are starting to look a little too similar.
Yeah,
you do not want to be compared to Scott Frost.
And in the context of this Oregon State game, David Bell will be the best player on the field. George Karlaftis will probably be the second best player on the field. You could go down the line a little bit from there, depending on how you feel about, you know, Aiden O'Connell or whoever. But they've got the best playmakers at premier positions on both sides of the ball. This is the second year of a considerably better defensive staff. Or I'm sorry, no, a new defensive staff. So they've got to show signs of things coming together here. Or I think the questions have to start being asked about a guy who, again, not all that long ago, turned down a big money offer from his alma mater to take a huge sack of money from Purdue. And now you're left kind of wondering, well, what happened since then? Did he really just get the check and nail it in after that?
Well, hey. What I need to mention is that actually it turns out AOC got primaried by Jack Plummer.
Did they make that decision?
They did. Three days ago. Jeff Brom.
That's recent.
Yeah, it turns out AOC was defeated by Jack Plummer in her district's primary.
That is too poetic, isn't it? Yeah, man. Look, Jack the Plummer is.
Well, look, he had huge. Plummer had huge backing from the fossil fuel industry.
From out of state, yeah. So,
they no, said, but anyway, we've done this before with those two, where it's really statistically difficult to tell them apart.
Yeah, it's fair to say that Plummer's a little better at evading the rush, which is why O'Connell doesn't usually make it through the season.
Yeah, and Plummer's going to be in there anyway. Why not just go with him from the get-go?
Yeah, who knows? It could be as simple as that. So he's got one of the best weapons in the conference. Throw to Horvath was an underrated weapon in the run game for them last year. You'd need more diversification and production there. But Purdue really needs to win this game. I think if they don't, then more eyes nationwide will look at this and be like, what? Wait. Last time we thought about Purdue, their head coach was a hot shot, turning down Louisville, getting a big raise. How exactly are they losing to Oregon State? I think that's a question that will be asked more.
They had the Ohio State game, but so too did Illinois have the Wisconsin game.
Yeah, and that was also that was in 2018, correct?
Yep.
That's a little bit of dust on that to not have any more recent accomplishments for a coach who I still think is thought of as something of an up-and-comer. So moving to our other, what I would refer to as interesting non-conference game, West Virginia at Maryland. Steve, did you know West Virginia was actually pretty good again last year?
I actually didn't. I hadn't thought too much about them.
Yeah, they ended up 6-4 overall. And really their statistics indicated that honestly, they're not bad. They had the best pass defense in the country last year. Would you ever associate West Virginia as having the best pass defense in the country?
No, but it's interesting because Neil Brown, right? That's their coach.
Yeah.
Let's see. Did he in fact bring who was their defensive coordinator? Oh, Gerard Parker, because he got rid of the best defensive coordinator Illinois ever had, I believe. Oh, no, he wasn't even in there. Wow. Oh, yeah, he was. Vic Cunning was the coordinator in 2019. And former NFL quarterback Matt Moore, I think, was the offensive coordinator. Anyway, I'm just jumping all around here. So
yeah, but
they had a new coordinator last year under Neil Brown, who was a defensive guy at Troy. That's where he comes from. It's his second season. It's going to be his third season as head coach.
Well, yeah, and let me ask you this. So if I were to say that West Virginia had two guys on the defensive line, two excellent players who were brothers, and again, they play for West Virginia, what would you assume their last name is?
I don't know. I just can't stop thinking about two brothers in a van. And so, then a meteor hit.
Right. I should have known that I was going to. So,
okay, so go on with it.
So the Stills brothers, of course.
The Stills.
If you talk about West Virginia football, you got to make sure that you account for where the Stills are. So they have a couple of returning stalwarts there. Their defense is going to have a lot of newer pieces on it, but there's reason to believe that they ought to be able to put this together. They have a returning starter in Jarrett Doge or Doge? You could probably tell me.
It's Dagey.
Are you serious? All right.
No, it's Dagey because he's related to former Texas Tech quarterback Seth Dagey.
Yeah, I wondered if there's a connection. Yeah, all right.
He absolutely is, because you'll recall at the time it was culturally relevant, their whole cheer was, teach me how to Dagey. Teach me how to Dagey.
Oh, no. Well, I can't. Okay, so before I was thinking, you know, I don't really have a dog in this fight, but knowing that there's that kind of connection, I can't in good conscience root for West Virginia in this game. So good grief. If this is going to be an interesting test for Maryland's reconstructing run defense in particular. West Virginia has a running back, Luddy Brown, who is excellent. He went over 1,000 yards in a short schedule last year. So if their infusion of talent up front hasn't yet translated into a better unit, they're getting out right away. This is a team with, again, a returning quarterback, really good offensive line, and an excellent lead running back, plus a lot of depth there. So, you know, honestly, in a lot of ways, there's some similarities to how Maryland's offenses are built here. But we'll see how this looks. Looking at a little bit more serious of an X's and O's perspective here, this is going to be a good early test for Maryland. What I assume will be kind of a new look defensive front for Maryland. They were terrible against the run last year. They brought in this huge infusion of talent in the defensive line and the linebacking group. West Virginia, in addition to having that returning quarterback, has a lot of returning experience on the offensive line. They have a running back in Luddy Brown who went over 1,000 yards in 10 games. So they are a serious threat on the ground. It's not the Holgerson sling it all over the place. They're much more of a balanced offense now. If Maryland's defense is not materially better up front, they're going to know it right away.
Neil Brown was very high on my coaching prospects list a few years ago, back when, you know, during the interminable times when I had to have that list at the ready at all times, because he was able to go toe-to-toe with SEC teams. I believe, didn't they beat LSU one of those years?
I thought they
got either LSU or Auburn.
I thought they got really close to beating LSU, and then there was a bullshit call that like ended the game.
Well, either way, they held their own against, you know, like NFL laden defenses, running a balanced attack and playing physical defense. So that I'm really interested to see that, because they seem like a very like what Neil Brown wants to do is have a team that controls the game and play very disciplined. And if I know Mike Locksley and Ron Zook, what they want to do is exactly the opposite.
Yeah, what they want to do basically is something that you would expect from like a Loki variant. Basically, I haven't ruled out the possibility that Ron Zook is a Loki variant, by the way.
Do you think that Mike Locksley knows better than to keep Ron Zook away from actually coaching anything? Like, do you think he's got him actually doing special teams? Or do you think he knows, hey, dude, this guy actually went to do special teams where that was the only thing he did up in Green Bay, and they were the worst in the league at it?
I don't know. You could make a compelling argument to me either way, I think.
I'm really curious. I mean, maybe Ron Zook's passion is special teams. Like, his other passion is graphic design, of course, but maybe his passion really is special teams, and it's just, he's just really bad at it, and he just wants to keep doing it.
You know, you always see it bandied about, like, it's okay to not monetize everything. Like, it's fine to just have passion products. Like, this podcast is a good example. You know, relative to the amount of time we put into it, the remuneration is truly, like, on an hourly rate, it's just dismal. And
I don't think I'm even getting those checks anymore.
Yeah, that's fine. Like,
I'm not paying for hosting anymore, so that's really all I care about.
Right. That's, as long as we're not losing money on something. Like, this isn't, you know, like pottery or metalworking where we're going to have raw materials expenses.
Or fixing up your car to take it to car shows where it's like, hey, I really want other people to think my car is cool.
Dude, don't get me started. That was one of the more fortuitous things about the timing of this vacation is we didn't have to be around for Dream Cruise. So anyway.
I hope my dad doesn't listen to this podcast.
Yeah, I'm sure it's right up Ken's alley, but all right, we're
you have no idea. So Penn State at Wisconsin, one of the two actually compelling matchups besides MSU Northwestern that we're getting in conference play.
Yeah, one of two matchups we get in week one of Big Ten, of ranked Big Ten teams playing each other. It's tough to know what to expect from Penn State because they were such a study in contrast first half versus second half of last season. Naturally, if you're a Penn State fan, the tendency would be to say, well, the second half was more recent, so that's more important. Okay, you can think that if you want. They do have some questions to answer, you know, defensive line, cornerback, some turnover there, but you've got carryover at their receiver and quarterback positions that'll be helpful. The offensive line is not great, but there are a couple pieces there that are really good. So you would expect the offense is probably going to be decent to begin with. And if nothing else, there's certainly a lot of talent on the defense. From Wisconsin's perspective, about all you can say here is the pieces are really all in place. Do you find the guy to be the dominant running back that you need? And why are you not just, why are you not just giving 25 carries a game to Jalen Berger? Is that going to happen this year? Do you feel that he's ready? Because again, the offensive line should be awesome. You still have Ferguson. Your wide receivers are still underwhaming, and the shine really came off Graham Mertz after those first couple games last year. So yeah. Really, this should look like a traditional Wisconsin offense, which is to say, most of the time, your opponent's not going to be able to stop the running game anyway. So what does it matter if you kind of suck through the air?
Yeah, there was very little data on Wisconsin last year, and the Penn State data was kind of like a corrupted save file. I don't know what to make of this. This is an important game, but I don't quite know how to. Wisconsin wants to control this game. I have to imagine that both teams are going to try running the ball first. Wisconsin, because it's what they're comfortable doing. Penn State, because they couldn't do it last year and they're going to want to prove that they can, right? Because you've got a big physical team like that should be able to do it. That's what you want to do. Of course, you have Devin Ford there who comes into this game armed with knowledge for a situation he'll probably never face again on when to go down when you have a clear path to score.
Oh yeah, I'd forgotten he was the one who did that.
I've been thinking about that, and like, how many times do you think that about times in your life where you did something that you ended up being the wrong thing and you think, well, at least I learned how to handle this situation that I'll never ever encounter in my life again. How many times does that happen? It's just like, no, I can't gain anything from it. I just took a big fat L and I'm never going to have the opportunity to redeem myself from it.
Yeah. And so that's a kind of an interesting thing you touch on there. It's not just that there's Evan Ford, but with him, Noah Kane, Keevon Lee, Keziah Holmes, Penn State actually has the deeper and better group of running backs.
No, for sure, by a wide margin, but it's never been about the raw talent of the backs for the Wisconsin. It's about the system. It's about the offensive line.
Right.
I don't know how much hay they'll be able to make against a Penn State front seven that's always talented, but it's relatively unproven.
Yeah, I would probably, because of that unproven quality to the Penn State defense, I would probably say this game leans in Wisconsin's favor. The game's also in Camp Randall, which always helps. So we'll see there. But again, assuming that Penn State's quarterback rotation has stabilized a little bit, which it kind of did down the stretch last year, they've certainly got the more dynamic weapons. You'd still think they're going to hit a couple of big plays. I'd probably give the edge to Wisconsin here. Home field helps, but it's probably going to be a compelling game, as will the last game of our slate be, which is Indiana at Iowa.
I'm going to say for PSU at Wisconsin, I like Wisconsin, but I'm going to take the under in the first half.
Probably so. Yeah. It wouldn't surprise me if, again, because Penn State is certainly, I think it's an obvious strategy if you're Penn State that you key on the running game. Wisconsin just does not have the types of threats that Penn State's corners shouldn't be able to handle one-on-one. And similarly for Penn State, your offensive line's not necessarily making room consistently for your running backs the last couple of years. You're relying on the home run play. Wisconsin may play it a little bit the opposite way. Prove to us you can run the ball, and we'll give your playmakers a little bit more space over the top, perhaps.
But I feel like if Penn State wants to be more comfortable, it'll be a bit like two Floyd Mayweathers going out and fighting each other. Yeah. Just like, all right, let's see what you got. And then nobody's throwing a punch. But you know what's going to be way more like that is, yeah, Indiana at Iowa.
Yeah, two of the more sound overall teams last year in the conference. Neither of them have glaring weaknesses. It's going to be interesting to see. I think Indiana's defensive front in particular gets a little bit underrated because they don't, aside maybe from Micah McFadden, they don't have anybody who has big time name recognition. They don't have obvious NFL talent. They use this system of this selective aggressive attacking that I think kind of makes more of the whole than the sum of the parts. Iowa tends to get automatic credit on the offensive line, but they do have a couple of new tackles this year. There have been times in the past where that hasn't gone automatically well. They'll be fine on the interior with, you know, Inch at left guard, and Linderbaum is the name everybody knows at center, who's probably, you know, he'll probably end up a Remington finalist. He'll be a mid-round pick if he goes pro this year. And with Tyler Goodson on offense, they'll run the ball and run it pretty well. But in passing situations, I wonder how Iowa's new tackles stand up against Indiana's aggressive, creative blitzing system. We'll see how that goes. And we'll also see how Petras does in his second year as a full-time starter, but also with what's probably a downgraded group of weapons. I know Iowa fans are pretty optimistic about Tyrone Tracy as a lead receiver. Sam LaPorta is a good tight end, but losing Amir Smith-Marset and Brandon Smith, I tend to think that they're still going to be taking something of a step backwards there.
Well, I actually asked Leah about this just yesterday. I asked my wife, if our hound dog were an Iowa offensive lineman, would she be, former Iowa offensive lineman, would she be Tristan Wirfs, Brandon Scherf, Mike Gruff, Riley Riff, or Brian Blah, blah?
And so how long did she just look at you quietly before you left the room?
No, she agreed that it would definitely be Tristan Wirfs.
Well, that would be Millie. That would be Millie.
Yes, that's the one I was talking about.
Sure. Oh, okay. All right.
No, because Moo would be much more like Eric Steinbach.
So then when Indiana has the ball, Iowa, as we mentioned in the offseason, has substantial turnover on the defensive line. Still some guys you could be confident about. Van Valkenburg had good production last year, but there was a lot more in the way of other proven threats that commanded attention. Their defensive backs, you assume, are going to be good. Riley Moss is back. They've got Kerner and Merriweather at the safety group. So the back end of the group should be good. If they get sound defensive line play from a couple of the new guys like Noah Shannon and Yaya Black at tackle, then the defense should really keep the ball rolling. And Phil Parker is one of those guys who I think is a little underrated from a national perspective in terms of earning the benefit of the doubt. It's but true that the they thing. Don't have a ton of proven guys, but until they show that it's going to be a down year, you probably assume they're going
to
be fine.
So here's the thing. You usually like to divide this into the four units, right?
Yeah.
One team's offense, defense, the other team's offense, defense, as far, and then find out what the weakest one is. It's kind of hard to say here. So I kind of feel like you subdivided it a little further, because I think that the weakest matchup here, the weakest subdivision of these, is Iowa's passing game, because Indiana's passing game is middling to strong, but Iowa's secondary is very good.
Yeah.
But I think ultimately the fact that if you're talking about both of the run games, then the front sevens and the secondaries, I think your weak spot is going to be Iowa's passing game.
Probably so. And made more so by the fact that, you know, pretend that Tyrone Tracy does take a step forward and is the number one type of receiver. Indiana puts Taiwan Mullen on him and he goes away. So are you really going to win a game against a team as sound as Indiana with only your tight end as a receiving threat? I don't know that you are. So,
and if you're going to talk about receiving threats that can be neutralized, well, I like the idea of anybody Iowa can put out there to be neutralized by Taiwan Mullen better than the idea that anybody can completely neutralize Freifogel.
Yeah, even with a solid guy like Riley Moss,
that's got also not just some skill, but a lot of rapport with this quarterback.
Right.
And how many
dozens of catches did he? Yeah. So anyway, it sounds as though I think both of us give a slight edge to Indiana here, even with the game being at Kinnick. It's again probably going to be very competitive. I don't have a ton of conviction in that pick. I probably wouldn't bet it for much in the way of money. but on paper, I think I like the matchup for Indiana a little bit.
You know what? I actually like it for Iowa because we're in 2021. And while on the surface, it looks like people want us to believe things are changing for the better. The most important promise that was made was that nothing will fundamentally change.
Your source for Big Ten Talk, it's Off Tackle Empire.